Accession number 20331, Reel 3.
As I was saying, that they had a lot of horse transport, but when you get men, horses, machines, meaning tanks, German lorries that are being burnt up, blown up, all in a very confined space, plus the heat of the summer, because the summer was very hot, and the stench is indescribable. In fact, I was talking to my oldest boy when the Gulf War was on, and they were we were talking about the retreat of the Iraqis back to Baghdad, where they all got shot up. And I said to my boy at the time, I said, same thing, different country. Exactly what happened, same thing, different country, and a different year. Anyway, once we got out the Falaise area, mind you, we weren't always in action. We did have rest periods, which we was taking out the line, and we had a chance of entertainment from the ENSA group, you know, the entertainment services, chance of getting a shower, you know, hot shower, clean clothing and all that. In other words, what you've done, you threw everything off, from your battle dress to your socks, underclothes, a lot. And you went in, had a shower, and when you came out, there's a whole new lot waiting for you, totally clean. Even down to the divisional sign sewn on, you know. And you could, you know, go to the Naffy van and buy up whatever you needed to buy. You know, if you wanted to buy toilet soap or writing paper, that sort of thing. And sometimes you was pretty free. Free time. I mean, not free to wander around anywhere, but in that space. So, I mean, there was nobody hollering and shouting at you, get on parade or tee up or whatever. And that happened, you know, throughout the whole of the Normandy experience. And then the next Art of Falaise, the next big action. And it was a big action, and it's as regards the Royal Engineers, it is a set piece exercise when they put bridges across rivers, because that was when the 30 Corps crossed the Seine. That was late August, and there's the town of Vernon on one side, and the River Seine at that point is very wide. I'm not sure whether it's 600 feet or 600 yards. I think it's 600 yards, but the ground on the other side is very hilly. So the 43rd Wessex Division had the job of forcing a crossing and having bridges thrown across as well at the same time on a fast flowing river with the they had a German battle group putting up a defence. Putting up a defence against the division making or getting a bridgehead across. Fortunately, it did eventually, But I believe it took 3, if not 4 days, you know, to really get into some depth. And excuse me, mentioning the book, I don't know if you ever read it, A Salt Crossing of the Seine. It's probably in the War Museum Library, and that's a good book.
This is by a chap called Ken Ford.
Yeah. Yeah. And then came the...
What did you see of that?
Pardon?
What did you see of the Seine yourself?
Well, actually, when our brigade crossed, we crossed by Bailey Bridge. The bridgehead was open, and we didn't see a lot of, meaning the brigade, we didn't have a lot of action because we was the third brigade over, whereas if we'd been the first, well, we could have been in dire straits. So, Lady Luck must have been looking after me again. But there was a slight skirmish. But once things settled down, and the 30 Corps, that was when there was the big breakthrough, which took the Guards Armoured Division up to Brussels and the 11th Armoured Division up towards Antwerp. And they took all our transport from us, so we was left high and dry, which we got back, you know, meaning, when I say transport, 3-ton trucks, because they were taking all the supplies, what they needed. In fact, it could have been quite a straight run right into Holland, but Antwerp at the time hadn't been... opened up, you know, as regards the docks. So everything was still coming from Normandy. Every bit of stores and supplies was still coming up by road. Anyway, the 7th Battalion of the Hampshire Regiment, we got allocated duties as in Brussels. And I never lived it up so much in all my life. You couldn't move along the streets, you couldn't pay for anything. They wouldn't let you. They was really welcoming. And we, being in the battalion, was stationed for a short while in the Hospital St. Jean, which had been used by German... the German army as a barracks, which is, whether it's still there or not, I don't know, opposite the Botanical Gardens. And we weren't allowed out for 3 days until we got ourselves all cleaned up, and meaning the vehicles, and then it was decided that the battalion will put on a guard mounting parade at the main gates of this hospital that had been turned into a barracks. And you never see anyone think it was guard changing outside Buckingham Palace, you know. Old guard, new guard, you know, the regimental colours and the Union flag flying there. And we had our own bugler, naturally. And he was doing all the bugle calls. Anyway, we've been there about 10 days, and somebody somewhere had given the order that we was to move, 2 hours to move. And we moved sort of late into the night and made our way towards Holland. And... we didn't know where we was going. All we knew, we had a route card or slip of paper. It says you will proceed to Eindhoven, Nijmegen, Arnhem, at the crossroads of Arnhem Market Cross, you will turn right for Apeldoorn, which was well up into Holland then. Well, we got as far as Nijmegen after 2 or 3 days, and the division eventually finished up on what they call the island. That is where the Rhine splits. One river is known as a Lech and the other one as a Well. Well, W-A-L. And the idea was we was going to relieve the airborne troops in Arnhem. But as we all know, that idea didn't come off. The reason being, one of the reasons being it didn't come off was because we was using one road from Nijmegen up to one road from Eindhoven up to Nijmegen because the road the land each side was all what they call it, dikes and that. So therefore we couldn't go over the fields. And also the other reason was the German army was achieving something which they never thought they would achieve by cutting our lines of communication up that road. So if you could imagine a normal two-lane road, you know, in any part of England, but being dead straight with 23,000 vehicles on it, all going the same way, and no vehicle was allowed on that road unless it had the strict permission to be on it. And the only traffic coming the other way would have been ambulances from the American 82nd or the American 101st Airborne Divisions, because they had dropped at Nijmegen and they dropped at Graaf. Have you ever been to Holland?
Yes.
Have you seen the Graaf Bridge?
No.
Well, I think it's 7 spans. And it crosses the Maas. And so that was a very important crossing. And that's why, and of course, I mean, the Americans, I mean, they treated us well, you know, they waved us on, you know, and limeys and all the rest of it. But up on the island itself, we got cut off 2 or 3 times between Graaf and Nijmegen. I mean, not just us, but the whole lot. And we finished up not far short of the airborne. I can only show you here.
Well, don't bother with the book because other people can't see it.
Yeah, but anyway, they realized the mistake was realized that if. Lieutenant General Horrocks has ordered the 43rd Division to go further west and force a crossing over the Rhine and thus work round the back of the German forces that was attacking the airborne at Arnhem, but that never came about.
What were conditions for you like on the island?
Well, we was in action. We was firing off mortars. There was quite a barrage going on. But there is one period of my time on the island which even today is totally blank. in as much that I was up on my feet 1 minute, and the next thing I knew, I was in a British Army ambulance going back to Nijmegen. And whether I was suffering battle exhaustion, or as the soldiers used to call it, bomb happy, I don't know. And I was in this hospital, or a place known as a hospital, put it that way. And I was in there, 24 hours, I suppose, after a good night's sleep. I was discharged, and I went back to what they call B echelon, which is part of the battalion, but that is the part of the battalion which is furthest away from the firing line. You've got F echelon, which is immediately behind the firing line, and then you get A echelon, which is basically administrative, and then B echelon, which is I suppose base. And I was there sort of another 24 hours, and then I went back to the mortar platoon. So when I was gone, about exhaustion or anything like that, I don't know.
What do you think brought it on?
No idea. No idea. Never did find out.
Were you under a lot of shelling?
Well, it might have been under. Well, there was a lot of nonsense going on. I mean, we even had the part of the German Air Force assisting along there. That's the first time we ever saw a German jet plane, Messerschmitt 262. But I mean, that didn't bother us. But no, there's quite a lot of noise going on. I mean, also. Maybe a lack of sleep, maybe just having come all the way from Normandy without any undue injury. Who could tell? I mean, battle exhaustion can come in many ways. I mean, a battle exhaustion can come, a bloke just sit in a corner and shiver. Yeah, another chap could be crying his heart out and shivering. Who knows? But I never did bother to find out. But recently, I spoke to a lady in the city who is whose father came to England with the Canadian Army in 1941, and he finished up in Normandy, and she was saying the self-same thing about her father. He's got about 48 hours blank in his life, which he doesn't know anything. So maybe the self-same thing.
Did you get any treatment in the hospital?
No, just a good night's sleep. There's an old site, there was a battalion commander or a colonel or something in one of the battalions in the division. He used to insist that all his soldiers slept. When they came out of the line, they slept. He didn't have no unnecessary parades. His philosophy was, a tired soldier is a useless soldier. Maybe it's quite true.
So what happened to you after you came back from the hospital?
Went back, with the mortar platoon. Nobody brought the subject up or anything like that. And, eventually, when the airborne was withdrawn from the town of Arnhem, It was a miserable night, in pouring with rain, cold, and all the rest of it. And then we finished up still there after the airport had been withdrawn. And we was we eventually was removed from the island. We went into the woods in Holland, in a place called Groesbeek, and we had taken over the area of some Americans who had been there, because I mean their slit trenches were all parachute lined.
Parachute line?
Line, yeah, the parachutes, what they came down on, that they lived like lords. They would wrap these camouflage slit parachutes into the slit trench, so wrap them around and keep them warm, I suppose. I don't know. Anyway, that was the October November time of 1944. And of course, there was various actions that was carrying on in preparation of taking villages up to the banks of the Rhine. And then, of course, we weren't always in the same area. One minute we sort of move further along, or be pulled out for a rest of maybe a week away from all action whatsoever. But even then, that it wasn't always resting. Sometimes you had kit replenishment, clean your vehicles and all that. I mean, there was a certain amount of maintenance had to be done as well on your vehicles, and if you rode on a grain carrier, I mean, the driver he was responsible for the mechanical side of it, but the other three men was responsible for keeping it sort of clean, and or giving a hand to keep it, giving each other a hand to keep it clean, inside and out. Because what we used to carry on a grain carrier was anything and everything that we required. You know, we used to carry our own food, water, fuel, maybe carry four gallons of petrol in a jerry can, and then plus ammunition, mortar ammunition. It all had to be sewed in its right place. You couldn't have that sort of stuff floating around too freely. And sometimes, you were sitting on quite a lot with your head stuck up the top, well above. But that was our home, a carrier, a brain carrier, was basically our home, because night time we could tie a big tarpaulin on the side of the carrier and peg it down, and we could sleep under in the dry. I mean, so and then of course our method of cooking was by what was originally thought up. They used to call them Benghazi cookers. It originated from the desert warfare, and the basically, it was a biscuit tin, the old army biscuit tin, filled with dirt and petrol poured in, and three jack handles. Well, it was used as a fire bars, so you stood your cooking utensils on top. And that was the original name of Benghazi cooker, as I said, came from the war out in the desert in the early days of the 8th Army. And we was a self-contained little unit, for for breakfast, dinner, tea and supper. And we all used to take turns. And the same as we used to take turn for the purpose of washing and shaving, because water was rationed, you know, as to how much we could use or the availability of it. And used to heat that up, same method, on a Benghazi cooker, and used to take it in turns. If I had clean water today, I'd go back to the end of the queue, or 4 days later, I'd get clean water again. Otherwise, you would share it. And the same as, you know, when you, in those days, you wet shaved. You wet shaved using water, you know, hot water, but you use your tea mug. You know, you used to put your hot shaving brush and rinse out your tea mug afterwards. And you used to use your tea mug to use a soap. All ingenuity. It's the same as when you if you was in a house, used it as a in the front line. There were no lights or anything naturally, but we would use these 50 John Player's cigarette tins, and we used to put dirt in them. A piece of a British Army bootlace, a leather bootlace, and we used to pour petrol in. So the petrol went up the leather bootlace, and you had the lid on the top of the tin with a small hole in it, so the leather bootlace followed through, and that was the wick. And you use that as the wick, and that gave you a certain amount of light. I mean, we never had such things as candles or torches. All these things were, I think a lot of these things were a follow-up of the way the soldiers of the First World War used, you know, when they was in the front line. But of course, I mean, our conditions were far better than what they ever had. Excepting that, from what I've read of the First World War, soldiers were often moved in and out of the line within 24, 36 hours for a rest, whereas we weren't. We was in the line for maybe 3, if not 4 weeks sometimes. But, as I said, the conditions were totally different then. 100% different. Anyway, then, did I mention about the Ardennes?
No.
Well, I'm sorry to have to go back on this, because it is important. The battalion was in the town of Meersen in Holland just before Christmas 1944, and two rifle companies and a couple of sections of the mortar battalion were ordered down to Liège overnight, and our job was, meaning the mortar platoon, to stand guard at these railway bridges, which were basically single-track wooden trellis bridges across the Meuse. And they were still in use by the Americans, but our instructions were, you don't move, you stay there. But fortunately, we spent a cold 4 or 5 days down there, but we weren't in any action whatsoever. And then when the German Air Force had its final fling on the 1st of January 1945, when they shot up every airfield that the Allies held, and that was their last time that they really had any real action. And then the other good thing was my name came out of the hat to come home on leave. First name out of the hat, you know, for the battalion. But fortunately, I wasn't able to move because the German Air Force was very busy. So I didn't come home on leave, not until sort of late January, early February.
Did you get shot up on the 1st of January?
No. What it was, I mean, we was like a load of silly idiots. All these planes came over, and as you know, the Allies had...